In mid-December, President-elect Bush came to the White House. We talked about the campaign, White House operations, and national security. I knew that he was putting together an experienced team from past Republican administrations who believed that the biggest security problems America faced were Iraq and the lack of national missile defense. I told him that based on the last 8 years, I thought the biggest security problems, in order, were Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, the absence of peace in the Middle East, the standoff between nuclear powers India and Pakistan, and the ties of the Pakistanis to the Taliban and al-Qaeda, North Korea, and then Iraq. I said my biggest disappointment was in not getting bin Laden, that we still might achieve an agreement in the Middle East, and that we had almost tied up a deal with North Korea to end its missile program, but that he probably would have to go there to close it. He listened to what I had to say without much comment, then changed the subject to how I did the job. My only advice was to put together a good team and try to do what he thought was right for the country. Then we talked a little more politics. December 23, 2000 was a fateful day for the Middle East peace process. After I invited the two sides back to Washington for a last effort at peace, and they had been negotiating for several days, my team and I became convinced that unless we narrowed the range of debate, in effect forcing the big compromises up front, there would never be an agreement. Arafat was afraid of being criticized by other Arab leaders. Barak was losing ground to Sharon at home. So I did what not long ago would have been unthinkable. I brought the Palestinian and Israeli teams into the cabinet room and read them my parameters for proceeding. These were developed after extensive private talks with the parties separately since Camp David. If they accepted them within 4 days, we would go forward. If not, we were through. On the 27th, Barak's cabinet endorsed the parameters with reservations, but all their reservations were within the parameters and therefore subject to negotiations anyway. It was historic. An Israeli government had said that to get peace, there would be a Palestinian state in roughly 97% of the West Bank and all of Gaza, that the capital of the Palestinian state would be in East Jerusalem, that the Palestinians would maintain control over the Temple Mount, and would have the Christian and Muslim quarters of Jerusalem's old city. The ball was now in Arafat's court. I was calling the other Arab leaders daily to urge them to pressure Arafat to say yes. They were all impressed with Israel's acceptance and told me they believed Arafat should take the deal. I have no way of knowing what they told him, though the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, later told me that he and Crown Prince Abdullah had the distinct impression Arafat was going to accept the parameters. On the 29th, Chief Negotiator Dennis Ross met with Arafat's trusted advisor Abu Ala, whom we all respected, to make absolutely sure Arafat understood the consequences of rejection. I would be gone. Ross would be gone. Barak would lose the upcoming election to Ariel Sharon. And President Bush wouldn't want to jump in after I had invested so much and failed. By the end of the year, I still hadn't heard from Arafat, so on New Year's Day, 2001, I invited him to see me at the White House the next day. Before he came, he received Prince Bandar and the Egyptian ambassador at his hotel. One of Arafat's younger aides told us they had pushed him hard to say yes. When Arafat came to see me, he asked a lot of questions about my proposal. At times he seemed confused, not wholly in command of the facts. For some time I had felt that he might not be at the top of his game any longer, after all the years of spending the night in different places to dodge assassins' bullets, all the countless hours on airplanes, all the endless hours of tension-filled talks. Or perhaps he just couldn't make the emotional jump from revolutionary to statesman. He had grown used to flying from place to place, giving mother-of-pearl gifts made by Palestinian craftsmen to world leaders, and appearing on television with them. It would be different if the end of violence took Palestine out of the headlines. And instead he had to worry about cleaning the streets and providing jobs, schools, and basic services. Most of the young people on Arafat's team wanted him to take the deal. When he left, I still had no idea what he was going to do. His body language said no, but the deal was so good I couldn't believe anyone would be foolish enough to let it go. Right before I left office, in one of our last conversations, Arafat thanked me for all my efforts and told me what a great man I was. "Mr. Chairman," I replied, "I am not a great man. I am a failure, and you have made me one." I had warned Arafat that he was single-handedly electing Ariel Sharon and that he would reap the whirlwind. In February, Sharon would be elected prime minister in a landslide. The Israelis had decided that if Arafat wouldn't take my offer, he wouldn't take anything, and that if they had no partner for peace in him, it was better to be led by the most aggressive, intransigent leader available. Sharon would take a hard line toward Arafat and would be supported in doing so by Ehud Barak in the United States. Nearly a year after I left office, Arafat said he was ready to negotiate on the basis of the parameters I had presented. By then, it was too late. He had an Israeli government that wouldn't give it to him, and an Israeli public that didn't trust him to keep his word. Arafat's rejection of my proposal after Barak accepted it was an error of historic proportions. The news is not all bad, though. Many Palestinians and Israelis are still committed to peace, and someday peace will come. When it does, the final agreement will look a lot like the proposals that came out of Camp David in July of 2000 and the 6 long months that followed. On January 3rd, I sat in the Senate with Chelsea and the rest of Hillary's family as Al Gore administered the oath of office to New York's new senator. I was so excited I almost jumped over the railing. For 17 more days, we would both be in office, the first couple to serve in the White House and the Senate in American history. But Hillary was on her own now. About all I could do was ask Trent Lott not to be too hard on her and offer to be Hillary's caseworker for Westchester County. On January 15th, Martin Luther King's birthday, as one of my last acts, I sent a message to Congress, the unfinished work of building One America. It was based in large part on the final report of the Commission on Race I had appointed and included a wide array of recommendations, further steps to close the racial divide in education, healthcare, employment, and the criminal justice system, special efforts to help low-income absent fathers succeed at parenting, new investments for Native American communities, improved immigration policies, passage of the hate crimes bill, reform of the voting laws, and continuation of AmeriCorps and the White House Office on One America. We'd made a lot of headway in the last 8 years, but America was growing more diverse, and there was still much to be done. On January 19th, my last full day as president, I issued a statement on landmines, saying that since 1993, the United States had destroyed more than 3.3 million of our own mines, spent $500 million to remove landmines in 35 countries, and was making a vigorous effort to find a sensible alternative to mines that would protect our troops as well. I asked the new administration to continue our global demining effort for 10 more years. On my last night in the now barren Oval Office, I thought of the glass case I had kept on the coffee table between the two couches, just a few feet away from my desk. It contained a rock Neil Armstrong had taken off the moon in 1969. The rock had been carbon dated to be 3.6 billion years old. Whenever arguments in the Oval Office heated up beyond reason, I would interrupt and say, "You see that rock? It's 3.6 billion years old. We're all just passing through. Let's calm down and go back to work." That moon rock gave me a whole different perspective on history in the proverbial long run. Our job is to live as well and as long as we can, and to help others to do the same. What happens after that and how we're viewed by others is beyond our control. The river of time carries us all away. All we have is the moment. Whether I had made the most of mine was for others to judge. It was almost dawn when I returned to the residence to do some more packing and share some private moments with Hillary and Chelsea. The next morning, on little sleep, I went to the Oval Office to write my note to President Bush, as his father had done for me. Hillary came down, too. We gazed out the windows to take a long, admiring look at the beautiful grounds where we'd shared so many memorable times, and I'd thrown countless tennis balls to Buddy. Then she left me to write my letter. As I placed the letter on the desk, I called in my staff to say goodbye. We hugged, smiled, shed a few tears, and took a few pictures. Then I walked out of the Oval Office for the last time. Within an hour, the peaceful transfer of power that had kept our country free for more than 200 years had taken place again. My family said goodbye to the new First Family and drove to Andrews Air Force Base for our last flight on the presidential plane that was no longer Air Force One for me. After 8 years as president and half a lifetime in politics, I was a private citizen again, but a very grateful one. Still pulling for my country, still thinking about tomorrow. I wrote this book to tell my story, and to tell the story of America in the last half of the 20th century, to describe as fairly as I could the forces competing for the country's heart and mind, to explain the challenges of the new world in which we live and how I believe our government and our citizens should best respond to them, and to give people who have never been involved in public life a sense of what it is like to hold office, and especially what it is like to be president. While writing, I found myself falling back in time, reliving events as I recounted them, feeling as I did then, and writing as I felt. During my second term, as the partisan battles I tried to diminish continued unabated, I also tried to understand how my time in office fit into the stream of American history.